welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. 1,000 years ago, the first Europeans made contact with the Western Hemisphere. Since then, the Vikings, with names like Leif Erikson and Eric the Red, have become legends that make it difficult to separate fact from fiction. That will be our task today when we speak to archaeologist William Fitzhugh about those legendary seafaring people. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. 25 years ago this week, Teamster Union leader Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. Born the son of a coal driller and a radiator cap polisher in Brazil, Indiana, Hoffa first became involved in the American labor movement in the 1930s when he organized an American Federation of Labor Union local with 4 co-workers from a freight warehouse. From that moment on, Hoffa's rise in the labor movement was rapid, in 1957 being elected president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Along the way, on a number of occasions, Hoffa was accused of racketeering and extortion, the most memorable such charge coming in 1957 when, in a nationally televised hearing, Hoffa found himself being questioned by Robert Kennedy, then chief counsel to the Senate Committee on Improper Activities in Labor Management. On July 30, 1975, Jimmy Hoffa phoned his wife and told her that he was supposed to meet a local mob boss for dinner, but that he had been stood up. He was never heard from again. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, almost 150 years after the last African slaves on American soil were freed, an Ohio congressman has renewed his efforts to have the U.S. government issue a formal apology to the descendants of those slaves. Representative Tony Hall, a Democrat, began his crusade in 1997, but has repeatedly failed to get his bill through Congress because of stiff opposition from blacks and whites alike. Critics maintain that actions speak louder than words, that doing something more tangible for the descendants of the slaves, like offering them monetary reparations payments, would be better than an apology. But Hall insisted an apology must come first. Then he would like to see a museum on American slavery built in the nation's capital. Anthropologists and their students from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln recently found themselves knee-deep in the remains of a Buffalo Soldiers barracks at Fort Robinson State Park in Nebraska. The team of researchers is attempting to fill in the record concerning the black soldiers 2 decades at the fort, which was destroyed at the turn of the century. During the 1870s and 1880s, the Buffalo soldiers gained widespread recognition for their battling Indians, repairing telegraph lines, and pursuing stagecoach robbers on the American frontier. Ultimately, the state hopes to build on the site historical replicas of the 17 Buffalo soldiers' barracks. You're listening to Talking History. This year marks the 1,000th anniversary of the landing of the Vikings in North America, and the event has renewed interest in, as well as new scholarship on, the people and the event. Popular opinion is that the Vikings were a bunch of thugs who pillaged and marauded, generally terrorizing the civilized world, making few contributions to the advance of Western civilization. Our guest today would quarrel with that assessment. He is William Fitzhugh, an archaeologist at the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., and the director of the Arctic Studies Center. Welcome, Dr. Fitzhugh.
Good afternoon.
So tell us, what's wrong with that picture as I just described it?
Well, almost everything, Brian. The Vikings have really got a bad rap in history, mostly because their tales about them made by Europeans who are on the wrong end of their sword. So actually, we've discovered through archaeological work and new historical research that the Vikings really were quite a positive force in the formation of modern Europe and, of course, in the exploration of various places in the world, even as far as into the Near East and beyond to India and the Caspian Sea and westward to Greenland and North America.
Okay, well, let's try to be a little more specific then. Who exactly were the Vikings? Where did they come from?
Well, the Vikings, it's a name that is not their self-given name. They were known to themselves as Danes or Sveres or Swedes or Norwegians and so forth. And It was actually, that term was applied to them by people in the British Isles and in areas of the Channel and northern western France where they were attacking. And it comes from, probably, and no one actually knows for sure, but it seems to come from a place in Oslofjord named Vik. And the people who came from there swarming out into northern Europe were the Vikings.
So it's just a broad, encompassing name put on them by others.
Yeah, and that's fairly frequent in history, that the people become known by their enemies or the people other than themselves.
Right. Okay, so when and why did they take to the sea in the first place?
Well, this is the late Iron Age period, and during that period, people in Scandinavia had probably moved in from northern Europe over the last millennium, carrying a lot of new technology like animal husbandry and iron technology and so forth, probably displacing local native peoples who had been there earlier or mixing with them. And they developed a very good farming economy, mostly based on stock raising and some cereal production. And their life got to be quite productive. And as this happened, they also acquired boat technology and learned how to build these fantastic Viking ships. And once mastering their construction and the use of sails and so forth, they were ready to travel over across the Baltic and the North Sea, and they developed trading relationships with people in the Channel area and the Baltic. And they probably really began to be very successful traders, but probably by around the late 700s, they realized that they had the military might and the transport capabilities and so forth to basically run around and take what they wanted instead of paying for it.
And that's how they got their bad reputation?
Yeah, because they would attack monasteries, attack towns that were defenseless, and in fact, much of Europe and the British Isles in this time was sort of a period of turmoil. There wasn't a lot of strong leadership and central authority, so that they found that by using stealth, coming in quickly, leaving quickly, they could get food, they could get wealth, they could take reliquaries from the church, tear apart the Bibles for their jeweled clasps and various other valuable church items and so forth, which they'd take back to Scandinavia and distribute among their followers or as booty and so on.
Okay, well, you alluded a little bit to it earlier, but what then did they offer to Western civilization? What contributions did they make?
Well, this is something that we're learning a lot more about, I think, through archaeology and also the excavation of the ships that have been uncovered in the mud in the various places in Scandinavia now. And just 100 years ago, we really didn't know much about how Viking ships were built, and the early paintings of the Vikings have them sailing around in contraptions you can't even believe. But the excavations now show Viking ship technology to be the most advanced in Europe at the time. And they learned how to use sails. They coupled that with oars, their navigation abilities, not really by instinct, because they didn't have a lot of fancy navigation instruments. They didn't have compasses. They didn't have any way to tell their position east or west. Longitude was unavailable because there were no clocks. But they could tell how far they were north or south by measuring the height of the sun at noon when the weather was okay. And they just learned how to get around the North Atlantic. It was a kind of an extension of navigation skills they had been developing over, probably 1,000 years earlier around the North European region. But it was another thing to tackle the North Atlantic and come to the New World. So those are some areas. They've given a lot to us in the shipbuilding business, and some boats are still made with the old Viking-style clinker technology in Scandinavia and Newfoundland today.
Anything beyond that?
I think trade. Europe at this time was starting to be heavily influenced by the Mediterranean world and the Near East, and the Vikings actually reconnected some of the parts of Europe, certainly northern Europe, with these centers of development in the south. And so they brought jewels and coinage into the north. They enriched European literature by their sagas and stories. The Beowulf story is one kind of example. They gave a lot to our linguistic heritage by moving into the British Isles and Normandy, bringing a lot of Nordic terminology and language into those into our modern English language. And so I think that, even when you just think about it from that point of view, the Vikings had a very positive force on what was happening and what later on happened in the world.
Pretty influential. Okay, we said they landed in North America 1,000 years ago. Well, what route did they take, and just how far did they go? Where did they make it?
Well, this until recently, this was really a big mystery because we only had the sagas, the Vinland sagas from Iceland, telling about voyages from Greenland by Leif Erikson and others of his family to the south and west. And we had to sort of guess on these locations based on things they saw and did there, like finding grapes, for instance, or certain fish, salmon and flatfish and hardwoods and so forth. We now think that they, certainly we know they got to northern Newfoundland because of the Lancemeadow site that has been recently found and excavated there. But then there are many other things that have been found, in especially in the Canadian Arctic regions. So we know that the Vikings were traveling up into northwestern Greenland, into Ellesmere Island, and places we wouldn't expect Vikings to go normally, except for perhaps possibly trade with the native people for walrus ivory. And there's been a big mystery how far south of Newfoundland they traveled, because there is a place called Hop that seems to be in the southern Vinland regions from the sagas, and there's no archaeological evidence for this yet. Maybe this is northern New Brunswick or Nova Scotia. Maybe some people think it's down in the coast of Maine or even as far as New York or something. But so far, there are no archaeological traces, direct traces of Vikings in those areas, no sites. There's one instance of a coin that has been found in an Indian site in Maine, on the coast of Maine, that dates to the late 10th century. An Olaf Kyrre coin, a Norwegian king, had this coin struck in the 1065 to 1080 period. So we know that that got down south, but we think it probably got there through native trade rather than direct contacts with Vikings.
Okay, you're not buying yet in on the claims for Rhode Island and Minnesota?
Well, I think those are interesting ideas, but they are ones that come out of the old romantic view of the Vikings. And there's been a lot of research, especially recently, on the Newport Tower. That was one of the first things that was identified as possibly a Viking origin back in the, really, 150 years ago. And now there have been studies that have pretty well nailed it as a 17th century stone windmill constructed by Benedict Arnold after a windmill of almost identical type found in his hometown in England. So we are pretty sure, and the mortar now dates to the 17th century through some new chemical tests and everything. So that is, I don't think that's an issue at all. The Kensington stone has been disclaimed by scholars almost ever since it was found, and there are some people today who still believe it's a true relic, but so far they haven't been able to convince scholars who have studied it and basically see it as something created by Mr. Oman as a kind of a prank initially, and then kind of got out of hand. And a lot of the Scandinavian Americans who live out there, of course, saw this as an element of their, you know, modern heritage reaching deep into the past. Even the Minnesota Vikings team on their website calls them, it talks about how their Scandinavians settled Minnesota 1,000 years ago. So it's got a deep popular appeal, but the science and linguistics just don't agree with it.
Sure. Well, when and why did they withdraw from North America?
Well, they were. I don't think that the Vikings ever did really withdraw fully. We really have to look at the new research shows an interesting pattern of an early period of contact in the Vinland period. This is like in the dates between 1000 AD and 1015 or 20 or something. And this is when the series of expeditions from Eric the Red's family came down and set up a village and explored and left us a lot of literary traces. And now some archaeological evidence. So I think those voyages were over very early, and they discovered at the end of that period that it was dangerous out here. The American native people were well-armed and well-able to defend themselves and to harass the Vikings, and wasn't only fighting. They were trading, they were communicating, and so on. But in the end, the sagas are probably correct in giving us a view of the Norse view of the Skraelings, the native peoples, as people that just were going to harass them to the point of making impossible for them to settle peacefully and productively in this rich new land. So that's one thing. But then, as the coin suggests, there must have been contacts later on in the 11th century, and then we have all of these archaeological finds from Hudson Bay, Baffin Island, even a little figurine of a native Inuit carved of a Norseman on the Hudson Strait side of shores of Hudson Strait somewhere in the probably 1200s or early 1300s, and then stuff in Ellesmere where a whole cache of Viking stuff or Norse stuff has been found in a Thule Eskimo village, things like pieces of chainmail. All sorts of things dug by Peter Schlederman up there, and it looks like this might have been a Viking boat that got wrecked in the ice, or a boat full of Vikings that got defeated by the Thule culture Inuit. So that's in the mid-1200s and maybe into the 1300s. And so I think that there was a sporadic contact of Vikings to the west of Greenland, probably for acquiring walrus ivory for trade with Europe. And I think that these kinds of contacts and voyages continue to be made over a 200 or 300 year period.
You keep making reference to the sort of the Vinland sagas, which in many ways later on in succeeding centuries were more or less seen as fiction rather than nonfiction. Do you subscribe to the theory that Columbus came into contact with these legends and believed them?
I tend to believe that that's so. I don't think that there is enough evidence to nail this down, absolutely. It's one of those areas of history that is kind of isn't well documented. It does appear that Columbus made a voyage to Iceland or to the Iceland waters, and it seems very likely that given the amount of information that the Norse collected and passed down in the sagas that was alive and was being recorded, you know, during those days and would have been fairly fresh in people's minds, it's hard to believe that word of lands to the west did not seep into the seamen's vernacular and become available, and even in Bristol and places on western shores of Brittany and France and so forth. So I think it's quite likely, but I don't know if we're ever going to have a smoking gun document that says there he was.
Right, probably not. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. We usually include in our program our historical state of the week, and this week we thought we would recommend to our listeners the exhibit that you curated, Vikings, the North Atlantic Saga, and that is currently at the museum. So you would certainly be the perfect person to tell us about it. So take a couple minutes and tell us about that particular exhibit.
Well, this is a great opportunity for us all in North America to learn a little bit about a people that we know very little about, and it was almost like a mythological part of the American past. And so we got together with the Nordic Council of Ministers and Volvo Corporation and did this really neat show talking about the homeland Vikings and their stuff, what their culture was like, their religion, their languages, their literature and technology and boats and so on. And we've got a really nice exhibit that sort of gives their background and then follows their expansion as they leave the homelands of Scandinavia and the British Isles, venture out into the North Atlantic to the Faroes and Iceland, and eventually pick up the trail of Eric the Red as he leaves Iceland and settles the Greenland colonies, and his son Leif, who then goes to America. And we also talk about the history of the 500-year history of Vikings in Greenland. So it's a show that combines a lot of good history with a lot of fun. We also talk about the legacy of the Vikings today. We have a image of the a replica of the Kensington Stone and various other things. Kirsten Flagstaff's costumed with her winged helmets and lots of things that are fun and are part of our Viking popular culture today. So it'll go around the country for 2 years after this, and we hope that a lot of people will be able to see it.
It's open until when?
It's in Washington until the 13th of August, and then it opens in New York on the 18th of October. And we're even hoping it might even get to the Midwest up into Minneapolis or somewhere toward the end of the period.
Well, that would certainly be appropriate. Very good. Okay, well, we'll leave it there, and thank you for joining us today. This was
very
interesting.
Thanks, Brian.
Great. Talk to you again.
Bye.
You've been listening to William Fitzhugh, Director of the Arctic Studies Center of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History and Curator for that museum's current exhibit, Vikings, the North Atlantic Saga. And this is Talking History. The past from communism to democracy has not been easy for Russia. Boris Yeltsin has come and gone, and the country's hopes are now set on another leader, Vladimir Putin. But just what can we expect from Putin? Can he be compared to any of our American leaders? That is the subject of our op-ed this week by Nicholas Gvozdev. Gvozdev is the associate director of the J.M. Dawson Institute of Church and State Studies at Baylor University. He is also the author of Imperial Policies and Perspectives Toward Georgia.
When Thomas Jefferson was inaugurated as America's third president, he noted the American experiment in democracy had passed a crucial test. Power had been transferred peacefully from one president to the next. This now being decided by the voice of the nation, all will unite in common efforts for the common good, he proclaimed. Two centuries later, another newly elected president, Vladimir Putin, echoing Jefferson, paid homage to the democratic process. The transfer of power is always a test of the constitutional system, a test of its strength, he said. In the presence of Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Soviet president who started the process of democratization, and Boris Yeltsin, Russia's first elected president, the new leader promised to safeguard what has been achieved. Despite the apparent connection between an 18th-century Virginia farmer and a 20th-century ex-KGB operative, Putin is not likely to turn to the sage of Monticello for inspiration. He is more akin to another statesman who also tried to lead Russia on the path of reform, Peter Stolypin, prime minister under Nicholas II. Stolypin's battle cry against revolutionaries, "You want great upheavals, but we want a great Russia," is echoed by Putin's call that Russia needs a strong state power and must have it. Indeed, Putin's actions so far seem more Stolypin-esque than Jeffersonian. Both Stolypin and Putin rose to prominence as law and order men. Both manipulated the electoral system to tailor pro-government majorities in the legislature. Both invoked the power of the state to push through fundamental change. Stolypin unleashed a series of reforms designed to turn millions of Russian peasants into property owners, with a stake in civil peace and economic development. Putin wants the state to become an efficient coordinator of the country's economic and social forces in order to ensure a stable growth of prosperity. Stolypin's model is attractive to Putin because, in the short run, it was successful. The economy grew at a rapid pace, the Russian military was modernized, and plans were drafted for a dramatic expansion of social services to the general populace. Stolypin's policies led Vladimir Lenin to conclude that his generation might not see the revolution. Unfortunately, time was not on Stolypin's side. His assassination and Russia's entry into World War I wrecked his work, and the Russian Revolution followed. As if haunted by Stolypin's ghost, Putin warned that the reform process is still far from completion, and we are running out of time. To see this process through, Putin is likely to adopt some very un-Jeffersonian policies. Benjamin Franklin expressed his optimism at the close of the Constitutional Convention that the sun painted on the back of Washington's chair was rising and not setting. It is too early to say whether the sunburst over the stage where Putin took his oath of office represents the dawn or the sunset of the nascent Russian democracy.
You've been listening to Nicholas Gvozdev, Associate Director of the J.M. Dawson Institute of Church and State Studies at Baylor University. Professor Gvozdev's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. For this week's segment of Coming Attractions, we'd like to call to your attention some very interesting programs about to air on the History Channel. On Sunday, July 30th, prepare for this year's Republican and Democratic National Conventions, scheduled to begin on July 31st and August 14th, by tuning in History at the Conventions. The program will take a look at the Republic and Democratic National Conventions of 1948, both held in Philadelphia and the first to receive television coverage. The Republicans nominated Governor Tom Dewey of New York, the Democrats, President Harry Truman. On Monday, July 31st, watch for Chain Gangs, The Untold Story. Chain gangs first came into use in the United States after the Civil War put an end to the use of slaves for many of the same jobs. In the early 1900s, prison crews paved and cleaned roads in all corners of the country. Much criticized for their brutality and violation of prisoners' rights, however, the chain gang was abolished in 1962, but it is making a comeback. Learn all about the history of this questionable American institution in Chain Gangs, The Untold Story. And on the same evening, July 31st, stay tuned for Wealth and Power that examines the lives of some of history's most successful tyrants, plunderers, and conquerors, including Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, King Louis XIV, and Napoleon. Be sure to check your local TV listings for exact times for all of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when, just in time for your summer vacation, we'll be taking a look at the history of the beach as a popular vacation spot. You won't want to miss it. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. I'm going to go to the next one.